This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll take a look at one community feeling the squeeze from police and fire pension costs. Also, there is renewed interest in historic homes, even though they can be a lot of work. Knox College in Galesburg is among those schools putting less emphasis on the ACT and SAT scores when it comes to admission.
All told, we don't miss it. We don't miss the test scores, and we're happy that other schools are joining that movement and happy that people are getting on that bandwagon because we think it's the right thing to do.
In the 1940s, Chicago played a key role in the Manhattan Project, which led to development of the bomb. But few people knew the research was taking place near them. We'll find out more. Also, the future of some Midwest minor league baseball teams is in doubt, but the clubs aren't going down without a fight. Those stories and more this hour on this episode of Statewide. This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, the thinking behind standardized testing is changing, and some colleges and universities are placing a lower priority on both the ACT and SAT scores. That includes some right here in Illinois. We'll have more on that. Also, Illinois played a big role in developing technology that resulted in development of the atomic bomb. We get a history lesson about it. And if you're a Christmas tree seller, well, this is the time of the year you've been waiting for. We'll hear what it takes to run such a seasonal business. That and more coming up on Statewide. First up, many cities across Illinois are struggling to meet required police and fire pension payments. In Springfield, every dollar homeowners pay in real estate taxes goes right back out to cover that cost. Next year, as payments grow, the city will need to come up with an additional $1.5 million. Mary Hansen explains why in this week's Illinois Issues report.
A few years ago, Bart Rovey bought a house on a brick street in Springfield.
I think the first week after I bought it, I think, like, oh man, I just spent, you know, $100,000. And, you know, I got a loan, and like, what did I just do?
Rovey says he was tired of renting, and so he traded rent for a mortgage and property tax payments. Since he bought the house in 2015, nearly all of the property tax he's paid to the city of Springfield has gone to fund pensions.
And I think that's kind of a shame.
Rovey says he'd like to see more young people like himself move to Springfield. He thinks it's an affordable city, but it needs to put more resources into the kind of entertainment and amenities that might get people to move here.
Then you have things like the old Y block north of Governor's Mansion, and they did that music thing last summer. Good things like that, but I'd like to see more of that with my tax money. And it sounds like we're not getting really any of that because it's all going to pensions, right?
Why is it all going to pensions, and how can the city fix it? In a lot of ways, Springfield is like other cities struggling under rising pension debt, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, one reason Springfield's debt payments are outpacing property taxes now is the capital city has decided to keep the same property tax rate for decades. For homeowners who say their taxes have gone up, I hear you. Keeping the rate the same does not mean you've been paying the same amount of money, because property values have risen. And don't forget about the other six or seven taxing districts you might be paying into too, like parks and schools. Still, for the city,
if you're starting from the position of, we're not going to change the rate, then by design, the pension contributions are going to outpace the property tax growth.
That's Amanda Cass, a researcher with the University of Illinois at Chicago. Property tax revenue has grown slowly while pension payments have ballooned. The taxes used to pay for the library and road projects, but no longer.
They're making a challenging situation even more challenging.
Under the state law, the Department of Insurance tells cities the minimum they have to pay annually for police and fire pensions. That minimum payment is based on the goal of getting to 90% funded by the year 2040.
There's no question that police and fire pension obligations are our single biggest obstacle to financial stability.
That's Bill McCarty, Springfield's budget director. He says he gets why Rovey and other taxpayers are frustrated that their money is being spent on what is essentially debt.
We have day-to-day services that our residents want, that they expect. We have to consider that, and we have to pay for that.
State lawmakers did approve a plan to consolidate all the hundreds of downstate pension funds, including Springfield's, into two. McCarty says the move would save the city some money down the road. The Illinois Municipal League has proposed another possible solution, lengthening the time frame to 2050 and reducing the funding target to 80%. McCarty says it's worth exploring, but not all are on board with this suggestion. Springfield Alderman Joe McMinniman says the city should in fact do the opposite, try to pay off the debt sooner.
So we're always playing catch up, and we're really transferring debt from this generation to the next generation.
He says to avoid this, the city needs to put in more money up front. Much like a home mortgage, the more you pay up front, the less you end up paying overall. Cass, the researcher, says policymakers have to answer a tough question.
Are we changing the funding target really with the best, most prudent kind of policy in mind, or is this really being done for kind of political reasons to not have to raise taxes, even if perhaps there's the capacity to raise the taxes?
Of course, researchers, politicians, and voters often have very different views of their capacity or willingness to pay higher taxes. I'm Mary Hansen.
Next summer will mark the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombs being dropped on Japan. It's one of the most controversial decisions in U.S. history. Research that resulted in the weapons of mass destruction took place at several locations, but Chicago became one of the main science centers. I talked with the writer Tara McClellan McAndrew about the work done in the state and the reason Chicago was a Manhattan Project site.
Well, there were several reasons. One was it was the home of Arthur Holly Compton, who was a physicist who was already working on some of this. Chicago was also seen as centrally located in the country so that other Manhattan Project scientists around the country could access it fairly readily. Also, the University of Chicago approved of being a Manhattan Project site and supported it.
This work going on, people unaware of it, in a very busy location in a major city, it seems kind of dangerous.
It does, doesn't it? It was a secret project, and secrecy was something that was drilled into everyone's minds who worked on the Manhattan Project. There have been some oral histories taking of people who worked on the project, and one was of William J. Nicholson, who helped create the pile, as it was called. That was what became the nuclear reactor that developed the first self-sustaining nuclear reaction at the University of Chicago. And he talks about this need for secrecy and how it was drilled into all of the staff there.
There were known agents of the German government in and around the University of Chicago. And we were told that, and that we were not to reveal anything of what you do. Don't take up with strangers. If you're having a sandwich someplace or a beer or whatever, watch out that people who may engage you in conversation would be damaging to the war effort, and that they may actually be the enemy.
So one huge question that comes up about this Manhattan Project site at the University of Chicago in the middle of this metropolitan site is, was there a danger? Was there a danger to the university, Chicago, Illinois, even the Midwest region? And the physicists I spoke to said, in essence, no. The nuclear reactor that the scientists were developing at Chicago was very low powered in comparison to what we see today. At most, it could have powered a 200-watt light bulb. Therefore, it was not putting out the kind of radiation that one of our nuclear reactors today could do, and therefore the harm was not significant. Now, there was some danger to the people who were in the room where that nuclear reactor was working. One of the dangers, although the scientists in charge had done innumerable calculations to make sure the danger was very small, there was still a worry that the nuclear reactor could get out of control. And they took protection against that, and they had what they called the suicide squad, 2 to 3 men who stood atop the nuclear reactor with a cadmium solution so that in case it did run away and start to melt down, they would pour this over the pile and hopefully it would stop. But as one scientist told me, the suicide squad would not live to tell about it.
The first nuclear reaction took place there, and it was momentous, you know, especially when you think about it in the terms of what would come later. But at the time, from what I read in your story to those folks, it was sort of matter of fact.
It was a big deal, but their reaction was a bit anticlimactic. They basically broke out a bottle of Chianti and all signed the basket that the bottle of Chianti was in, and that was pretty much it. The physicists I talked to said that the lead scientist on the reactor, Enrico Fermi, was so sure he had done endless calculations. He carried his slide rule around with him. For those who don't know what a slide rule is, that was your pre-computer calculator in the days. And he carried that around with him. He did endless calculations to make sure he knew what was going to happen with this nuclear reactor. And so it went exactly as planned. And in essence, while it was an enormous event, it changed our lives. It changed science and international relations forever. The scientists there just pretty much congratulated each other and broke out a bottle.
Were the scientists concerned about the use of this technology going forward? I mean, from the time they were working on this, had they had some idea in their mind that they could be unleashing something that they will never be able to put back in the bottle, so to speak?
The folks I talked to said that the scientists, of course, are smart people. These were literally some of the greatest brains of the 20th century, scientists at the top of their field. They knew the potential of the science that they were working on, and did they know immediately that they were working on a bomb? It's kind of unclear. They certainly became aware of it as their work went on during the Manhattan Project. And after it became clear that there would be a bomb developed from their work, some of them became very concerned about that, some of the Chicago scientists especially. And they developed the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists of Chicago to work on trying to control the use and thoughts and opinions about this new power they had unleashed. After the Met Lab in Chicago achieved its goals of creating plutonium and creating the first self-sustaining nuclear reactor, both of which were essential for developing atomic bombs for the war purpose, some of the scientists continued the work on the possibilities of this new nuclear power, specifically some of the peaceful purposes of it. And they continued that work at Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont, which still exists and still works today.
We talked about the concerns that something could go wrong, possibly, maybe be dangerous to people around it. At the same time, there was also concerns that the Germans, especially, would find out that this work was being done there in Chicago could become a target during the war. That is something that was drilled into people as well.
Yes. In fact, some of the Chicago scientists working on the Manhattan Project were refugees from fascist Europe. And I spoke to a physicist who wrote a book related to the Manhattan Project, and he talks about how they had feared that the Nazis would bomb Chicago specifically because of the work and because of the refugees there.
Here's physicist Stanley Wirt.
They felt quite rightly that the Nazis basically wanted to kill them.
Right.
In fact,
right.
I found an interesting little note in the Argonne archive many years ago. It said, in effect, of course, the Germans must know we're here, so when they have an atomic bomb, the first one they'll drop will be on Chicago. Mm. That was the risk that they foresaw to Chicago area, that the Germans would drop an atomic bomb on them.
So we know that people high up in the military, I'm guessing, would have known about all of this work, and you know, the president's administration maybe would have known about what was happening here. Did everybody at the University of Chicago, even the administration there, know what was taking place?
The Manhattan Project was extremely secret, ultra secret. I've read in one place that even Truman didn't know about it, which I have a hard time believing, that Congress didn't know about it. Again, I haven't verified. And the big question, even today, is did the University of Chicago president, Robert Hutchins, know what was going on in his own backyard, almost literally, beneath his football stadium? And it sounds like there's a lot of disagreement about that. Now, I have since read the Robert Maynard Hutchins, A Memoir by Milton Mayer, and he says he absolutely knew about it, but was under instructions that when he told his deans and trustees, number one, he could not even mention the word uranium, and that when they asked him if there was any danger to the university or city, he said unlikely, but he couldn't rule it out. Now, here's what a physicist at the University of Chicago, a current physicist whom I interviewed, said about whether or not he thinks the president knew.
He had to know. It was only two blocks from his house. Historians can debate it, but I'm sure he knew about it. He just couldn't officially know about it because you can't, as I said, you can't ask, can I make a nuclear chain reaction on your campus in the middle of the city? The answer is, heck no.
That physicist is Dr. Henry Frisch, and his story is very interesting because he is literally a Los Alamos baby. His parents worked on the Los Alamos project, and that's where he was born.
Today there is a monument that's at that site that recognizes that work. Talk about that, and is it something that people on the campus pay a lot of attention to or remember that this took place there? Or is this just something of the past that people have mostly forgotten?
That's a great question. Yes, there was a sculpture placed atop the site where the nuclear reactor was. It's right next to this beautiful new library they have. And the sculpture is very abstract. It looks like a nuclear mushroom cloud. Some people says it looks like a human brain. I think that was intentional on the sculptor's part. And when I interviewed Dr. Henry Frisch, again, a physicist currently at the University of Chicago and literally a Los Alamos baby himself, his parents worked at Los Alamos, he said that the University of Chicago has kind of split feelings about being the site of the first self-sustaining nuclear reactor in the world. He says that they have celebrated the 75th anniversary of that nuclear reactor going critical, but that there are some people who feel very uncomfortable about it because of course, how that power ended up being used and what it has done today to our international relations and potential of war.
That's the writer Tara McClellan McAndrew. More of her story about the role Illinois played in the Manhattan Project is available at our website, statewideshow.com. You're listening to Statewide. Stay with us. There's more to come. We're back on Statewide, and just ahead, one community is finding older homes are attracting new residents. And what is the future of minor league baseball? Changes could be on the way, and it could impact some Midwest teams. That and more still ahead. African swine fever has been infecting its way through the pig herds of Asia. And for Harvest Public Media, Amy Mayer reports while the disease is not here, the U.S. pork industry is preparing for a possible crisis.
African swine fever infected China in August 2018, and since then, it's devastated the world's largest pig herd. And that's got pork producers here worried. So in September, 14 U.S. states and the federal government held a four-day simulation exercise to test their preparedness.
You're in charge. What do you want? You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well.
On day two of the simulation, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Negg took a break from the role-playing at the State Emergency Operations Center near Des Moines to talk to reporters about how it was going. He said the simulation poked some holes in the plans, which is exactly the point. And he said, as the nation's number one pork-producing state, Iowa has a critical role.
If we're a leader in production, we ought to be a leader in how we respond.
The exercise tested how states would get the first samples to the U.S. Department of Agriculture lab on the East Coast, and how to stop trucks moving pigs, feed, and manure. Amanda Lutjens joined the exercise from Christensen Farms, where she's the animal welfare auditor.
We are spending a lot of time and energy working on these plans that all of us hope we never have to use.
She says they keep track of every person, pig, and truck that comes and goes from each of the 400 Christensen-affiliated farms.
We also understand this is a new and evolving beast, so it's going to be changing.
To be clear, African swine fever is nowhere in the Western Hemisphere, but it could arrive on any plane from an infected country.
It won't come across our land borders unless it first gets into a different country.
That's Iowa State University veterinary medicine professor Jim Roth. Roth participated in the simulation from USDA's incident headquarters in Maryland. He says Asia has provided a sobering reality check. From China, the virus has spread to North Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Myanmar, and the Philippines.
We've learned a lot from what they've done in those other countries. What we've learned is they haven't been able to stop it, so we need to really be prepared.
And even while the U.S. was running its hypotheticals in September, the disease spread to South Korea, a country considered almost as prepared as the United States. This newscast says that the disease has been confirmed and explains it's nearly 100% lethal to pigs and has prompted government officials to launch efforts to contain it. 2 weeks after the simulation and the South Korean announcement, I caught up with Ross and his colleague, veterinary pathologist Kyunjin Yoon. They pieced together what happened in South Korea and what it implies for the readiness of the United States. Farmers expect to see sick pigs at times. South Korean producers were coached to monitor for specific symptoms. Yoon says those didn't always show up.
Immediately, people recognize that the clinical signs that the textbook describes is not always there.
So now, and for U.S. producers, Roth says don't wait for additional signs if a pig has a fever or stops eating.
The message is call a veterinarian right away.
But Roth and Yoon agree that should the United States become positive for African swine fever, pork dumplings and bacon could become scarce worldwide. Precautions remain strong. Some swine shows and events have been modified or canceled. Oklahoma recently became the 23rd state to ban feeding cooked food waste to pigs. And the USDA has brigades of beagles sniffing for contraband salami at airports. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
This is Statewide. Most of the houses in downtown Belleville are more than 80 years old, and many of them were built decades earlier, in the 1800s. The older homes are attracting a new crop of residents to the neighborhood. Eric Schmid reports the reasons are both practical and personal.
Walk along Charles Street, south of Belleville's Main Street, and one house quickly stands out. The home is tall and stately and looms above others on the block. It's built in the Second Empire style, popularized in late 1800s France. The original bricks peek through white paint that once covered it in the past. It's imposing, and the inside is equally impressive.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, come on in.
The front doors open to a vast hallway with high ceilings and a huge mirror that can't be removed because it's too big to get through the doors. Paula Hanischewski and her husband, Tom, own the house.
A massive, over 5,000 square foot historic home.
They decided to buy it for $170,000 after walking by it every week for almost 2 years. Hanischewski shows me around and points out some of the details that make the home special.
All the fireplaces are still here, original. They are all carved mahogany. The butler's pantry is all original, and we still have a lot of the keys.
Their story is somewhat common around Belleville's downtown. In the past 5 to 10 years, people started to snatch up other historic homes, some on the grand scale of the Hanischewskis and others smaller. Some have aged well, while others need intense work. So why put in the effort?
You can find a lot of home for a little bit of money.
Jason Buss is a local realtor with RE/MAX. He says historic homes are relatively affordable compared to many other parts of the country.
You can buy the homes for, you know, $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 and then take your time renovating them.
People who buy historic district homes can also save money on their property taxes. The state of Illinois will freeze a home's property tax rate for 8 years if a homeowner invests a quarter of the assessed value at purchase into restoration or renovation. Beyond money, Buss says historic homes have a distinct appeal.
People love the character of old homes, the quality of how they were built, the workmanship that went into it.
He rehabbed and rented many homes in the area for more than a decade before becoming a realtor. He says their quality is unmatched.
You can't build these homes like today, like they were built then.
Dave Braswell is a Belleville resident who's rehabbed nearly a dozen homes since 1977. He says home quality and price are big draws, but so is being walking distance from downtown shops and restaurants. Those reasons are driving a new crop of people to the city's historic homes.
Mostly those in their mid to late 20s, early 30s. Are they young couples like I was 30 years ago?
He admits owning one of these homes is not trivial. Even ones that don't need a full restoration require consistent attention and sometimes extra work. Braswell says it takes people with skills.
That is people who can do some carpentry work, people who like to work in the yard, people who can do painting and so forth. These types of skills really do help.
Hanaszewski says her house needed a lot of attention when they bought it nearly 3 years ago. She flips through old plans and points out some of the issues she and her husband had to address.
I mean, we spent a lot of time landscaping this house because everything was so overgrown. This entire north side of the house was covered in invasive vines.
The inside was no better. Hanaszewski says they had to sift through and discard mountains of items the previous owners left behind. They removed carpet, wallpaper, wood from staircases. It was so much material, the Hanaszewskis rented dumpsters to take it all away.
40-yard dumpsters, six of them, with this house.
They've worked for the past 2.5 years to restore the home to its former glory.
It was a huge project. That's putting it lightly.
And they're not even done yet. The second floor still needs finishing. It may be a lot of work, but Braswell says there's a big payoff for those who put in the effort.
There's a great pride in doing an old home.
Braswell says his neighbors like to open their homes to each other, to share the fruits of their labor. And that's true for Paula Hanaszewski. She wants to open her home for events, weddings, or other gatherings once the restoration is complete.
I would really like to see it as a space that people could use, that the public can engage in, that kind of has an identity.
Hanaszewski says it's the ultimate reward. In Belleville, I'm Eric Schmid, St. Louis Public Radio.
Major League Baseball is considering a plan to eliminate 42 teams from the minor leagues, and some Midwestern teams are among them. Zach Wilson has that story.
The Clinton Lumber Kings and Burlington Bees are on the list, and the Quad Cities River Bandits could be added to it. The MLB wants to totally realign its minor league system, but has not yet provided its reasoning to the public. The current contract with Minor League Baseball ends following the 2020 season, providing an opportunity to restructure at that time. Jeff Lance, Senior Director of Communications for Minor League Baseball, says he hopes the two sides can work something out.
We have yet to hear exactly why those 42 teams were selected or be given, you know, real good reasons, but hopefully that'll take place here in the next few weeks.
Quad Cities River Bandits owner Dave Heller says there is no chance his team will be eliminated.
I will do whatever I have to do, spend whatever I have to spend to make sure that the Quad Cities ballpark exceeds all minor league standards and provides a great opportunity for major league teams to develop.
He says that the MLB sent out surveys to each team in the league asking them which of their minor league teams they would eliminate. These were sent out in June while flooding was an issue up and down the Mississippi River, as well as in some of the stadiums. So, naturally, teams in this area caught a bad break and were selected. Lumber Kings general manager Ted Torno says he thinks the league is doing it largely to save money on payroll, but they only pay each player $1,500 per month for teams at the Lumber Kings level, which pales in comparison to massive contracts in higher leagues.
Player-wise, you're looking at about a payroll of about $200,000. Each club just got from the Fox $5.1 billion deal, $170 million split equally between 30 teams. And they're crying about $200,000?
Torno says these are teams that are deeply important, not just to the brand of baseball, but to their communities.
We're community owned. So that in and of itself is probably the number one thing. I have 1,000 shareholders who purchase stock. Okay, so since 1937, there's been shares of stock sold, and baseball's been played here in the facility.
The River Bandits, on the other hand, are well known for their charitable work throughout the area. Dave Heller says he wishes the MLB would recognize the value that these teams bring outside of just putting a product on the field.
We pay out $85,000 worth of college scholarships every single year to students in the Quad Cities. We pay for free flu shots for every child in the Quad Cities. We raised $101,000 in partnership with Genesis to help victims of this past year's horrific flood. The impact of getting rid of the Quad Cities River Bandits in the Quad Cities would be enormous.
In addition, Heller says the team employs around 200 people at Modern Woodman Park throughout the entire season, and per game, the Lumber Kings employ 35-plus people to run the park. The possibility of eliminating 42 minor league teams has gained such widespread attention that over 100 members of Congress have chimed in. An official letter signed by representatives from both parties was sent to the New York office of Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred in firm opposition. High-profile politicians like Senator Bernie Sanders have also commented on the issue. Whatever new contract is signed between Major League and Minor League Baseball, it's going to be instrumental in which, if any, teams are eliminated. Dave Heller vehemently believes it would be catastrophic for the game.
And I gotta believe Major League Baseball people are smarter than that and will do something smart and intelligent and protect the River Bandits and protect the Bees of Burlington and protect the Clinton Lumber King and stop this foolish, radical idea of contracting 42 teams.
The communications team at Major League Baseball did not respond to a request for comment. I'm Zach Wilson.
High school students throughout the decades have sweated over the college admissions tests, both the ACT and the SAT. A high test score could help a student get admitted to the college of their choice. On the other hand, a lower score could dash those dreams. But the conventional thinking about those standardized tests is changing. About 1,000 colleges and universities across the nation now either don't require the test scores or are placing a lower priority on them. Rich Egger tells us about three such schools in Western Illinois.
The sound of chimes rings across the Monmouth College campus at the start of every hour. This private liberal arts college has a tradition of educating students since 1853. This fall, the college announced a new tradition. It will no longer require students to submit ACT or SAT scores when they apply for admission. President Clarence Wyatt says it's a matter of equity.
Study after study, including studies done by ACT and SAT themselves, have indicated that people from less advantaged backgrounds, as a rule, do not do as well on standardized tests as those young people from more socioeconomically advantaged backgrounds.
About 1,000 students attend Monmouth. Wyatt believes the school's new test optional policy could help boost that figure. He says test optional colleges and universities generally see an increase in applications.
Because it has removed an obstacle from many of the young people who otherwise might not have chosen to apply to the college.
Wyatt says Monmouth is more concerned about the strength of a student's high school record and indications of a student's leadership. He says test scores have been a lower priority, will remain so, and will no longer be required. About 15 miles away in Galesburg, the bells at Knox College ring to mark the start and finish of each class period. Sometimes a train horn harmonizes with the bells in this old railroad town. Test optional is nothing new at this private liberal arts college. President Teresa Amat says Knox adopted the policy in 2005 and has no regrets.
All told, we don't miss it. We don't miss the test scores, and we're happy that other schools are joining that movement and happy that people are getting on that bandwagon because we think it's the right thing to do.
Amat cites a study done by a college that adopted the test optional policy early on.
Their experience is that there is no significant difference between those with high scores and those with low scores in terms of completion or academic distinction at the institution. What it's really a good predictor of is your ability to take standardized tests.
Amat says it's difficult to tell whether the policy has affected enrollment. She says regardless of that, it was the right thing to do. The carillon at Western Illinois University echoes across the Macomb campus at around noon each weekday. This fall, Western announced it will become the second public university in Illinois to adopt a test optional policy. Western's policy will be a bit different from those at the private colleges we've heard from. It will apply only to students with a high school grade point average of 3.3 or higher. Director of Admissions Doug Freed says a sliding scale will be used for evaluating applicants with a lower GPA.
So the higher your grade point average is, the more medium your test score could be. But if you're towards the lower end of our GPA scale, then we'd be looking for higher test scores.
Freed says Western won't throw out test scores entirely. A higher score could help a student receive more scholarship money, and Western will still use the test scores for placing students in math and English. Freed says Western decided to adopt the test optional policy after reviewing national research.
And the data shows that high school grade point average is the best predictor of success.
Freed says the new policy could help boost enrollment, but he says that was a secondary consideration. He says Western, just like Monmouth and Knox, wants to make sure it's being fair with prospective students and is attracting those who've answered the bell, not just on one day, but day after day throughout their high school years. Rich Egger reporting.
We're glad you're tuned in to Statewide. You can find this episode and all the others at statewideshow.com. Stick around, there's more to come. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, the life of a Christmas tree seller. We'll hit the streets and find some. Illinois has more than 850 school districts. That's the third highest of any state in the nation, and some are just single schools with fewer than 100 students. Getting districts to merge or consolidate has proved difficult. We listen back to a story from earlier this year with our education reporter, Dusty Rhodes.
Last summer, Mark Ambrose became head coach of a new football team. At the first workout, he set the tone by sitting down in the middle of the floor.
If I'm a 240-pound guy, and then I had like a guy from Oblong come up, try to pick me up, who really struggled to do it, and I had another guy try to pick me up, you know, kind of with him.
Then Coach Ambrose called over a third athlete.
And all three of them could easily team up to pick me up, and I just use that as an example to say we're stronger together.
Stronger Together became the team's motto, featured on t-shirts, chanted by cheerleaders, crafted into a banner by kindergartners. It was crucial, Ambrose says, because the team was a new co-op, combining students from three East Central Illinois high schools, Palestine, Hudsonville, and Oblong. The team was established just a few months after two of those towns, Palestine and Hudsonville, attempted to carry their merger beyond sports by asking voters to approve consolidation of their school districts.
The first time I visited Palestine, I remember seeing a billboard that was specifically saying to vote no.
How emotional were people about this?
Oh, extremely.
That's Aaliyah Blackburn, a reporter with WTHI, the CBS affiliate in nearby Terre Haute, Indiana. She covered a series of town hall meetings and says each one was packed.
You could tell in the passion in their voices and, you know, the expressions on their faces, their body language, that this is something they deeply care about.
But even though the towns are less than 9 miles apart, with a total of only 750 students, they decided their school districts were stronger apart. This scenario isn't uncommon in Illinois. With 852 districts, some with fewer than 50 students, consolidation comes up and gets voted down a lot, despite the fact that it's got supporters in both political parties. Two different think tanks, the Better Government Association and the Conservative Illinois Policy Institute, have advocated for more districts to consolidate. IPI says consolidation would cut taxes by reducing the number of school superintendents who get high salaries and fat pensions. BGA points to the stability in academic programs that could come from a more robust pool of teachers. So what's the problem? Legend has it that nobody wants to lose their mascot. But plenty of schools co-op sports, like Ambrose's football team, and manage to compromise on the mascot. Money can be a big sticking point if one district has debt or pays their teachers higher wages. And State Senator Chapin Rose, a Republican from Mahomet, suggests it's the math of mileage.
I believe there's a lot of districts out there that want to explore consolidation, but once they find out that their kids are going to be on a bus driving for hours in one direction, just sort of ends the conversation.
He's pitching a plan that would allow any elementary district to dissolve and disperse its students among multiple neighboring districts. Right now, they have to pick just one. His plan got a green light in a preliminary hearing when he told lawmakers about a school he represents.
You have a school district that is having a hell of a time operating with 80 kids K-8. 80 kids K-8.
Another measure, sponsored by State Representative Rita Mayfield, a Democrat from Waukegan, would form a commission to see which districts could save money by consolidating and then give taxpayers the chance to vote. The Senate version of that measure would limit it to so-called non-unit districts, districts that only go up to 8th grade or districts that serve only grades 9 through 12. For now, small districts will continue creatively combining special ed services, sometimes food purchases, and of course, sports teams. Coach Ambrose's team, known as OPH, won more games in its first season than either Palestine, Hudsonville, or Oblong had won in the previous year.
We won three games, and I have many guys who've never won a football game the whole time they've ever played football. They just worked well together.
I'm Dusty Rhodes.
You're listening to Statewide. SIU trustees meeting this week gave updates on enrollment and retention, as well as a closer look at a potential funding reallocation plan. Both the Carbondale and Edwardsville campuses report applications are up by more than 20% for the next academic year. Leaders say they're working to turn those applicants into enrolled students. The interim SIUC Chancellor John Dunn says his campus is looking for unique areas of opportunity, like the Riverside School District in California.
They have 40,000 students, and their diversity measures are really good. And there's so much potential and possibility. So the idea there is to remind them that you can come to SIU Carbondale at the same tuition rate as any Illinois resident. And furthermore, we can do some of this distance delivery.
Meanwhile, SIU trustees also began discussion of a funding reallocation plan. A working group has spent the last several months on that proposal, which holds state funding at current levels for each campus, but it divides new money 50-50 between Carbondale and Edwardsville until the fiscal year 2022. Some trustees say that's too long. They want to see more emphasis on the base funding levels. Others say they want to give the incoming SIU president, Daniel Mahoney, who was approved this week, and a new Carbondale chancellor, time to work through the complicated task. Well, with the holidays upon us, we thought we'd take a moment to hear from those who are in a seasonal business. You see them in a lot of locations this time of year, the Christmas tree sellers. And this week we revisit a story from 2016 from a WBEZ segment known as Curious City.
Ho, ho, ho. I'm WBEZ reporter Monica Eng. And if you're like me, you may be super busy these days trying to tackle presents, greeting cards, holiday lights, making organic fruitcake, and canning the Christmas sauerkraut. Oh yeah, and the tree. That's what our latest question's about. See, Jessica Tansy was running errands on Thanksgiving weekend when she saw
a bunch of different little Christmas tree pop-up shops, I guess you would call them, and just kind of got to wondering, how many trees do they sell a day, a week? How do people get into the business? Where are they coming from? What keeps them in it? What's hard? What's great? Just kind of wondering all the things about it and who the people are behind it and what their stories are.
Wow, that's a lot of questions. But we'll need to get this done by Christmas. So I'll zero in on just that last part. Who are these folks selling trees? We'll hear from a few of these characters who work in the biz. Each got into this whole Christmas tree racket for different reasons. And you'd be surprised at where their trees come from, where they come from, and how much money they can make. Okay. We have just a few days to figure this out, and that Christmas sauerkraut isn't going to can itself. So right away, I meet up with questioner Jessica at a piney-smelling Wrigleyville lot.
Question.
Yes.
It's so nice to meet you.
Yes.
We've heard there's a Christmas tree legend working here.
My name is Ivy Speck, and we use this lot all year round for the cub season as well. So from April to this year, it was November, we've been parking cars for the World Series fans coming to see the Cubs. And then every year for the last 28 years, we turn it into a tree lot.
Her place is Ivy's Christmas Trees at Roscoe in Sheffield. And she sells almost exclusively the king of trees, Fraser firs from North Carolina. She used to get a variety of trees from all over the Midwest.
Little by little, we start bringing these in, and nobody was buying our other trees.
But Jessica's got even more questions.
What are your hours during the week, and how many trees do you sell, and how many deliveries do you get? Like, what are kind of those nitty-gritty logistics?
We can sell up to 100 during the week, maybe 200 on a weekend day. Yeah. Deliveries? Yeah, lots.
Then there are the money questions. I know the city makes all lot owners get an itinerant merchant's license. That's $50 a month. But what about profits? One tree industry website says vendors can buy trees for $15 to $25 and sell them for more than three times that. Ivy pays more, like double that, because they're all primo trees, no pines or cheaper varieties. So how much does she make a season? I tell her that one site estimates profits of $15,000 to $20,000 a month.
Okay. Sure. I wouldn't work here if I only made that, though. Those are my secrets. Yeah, but I will tell you, though, guys, a lot goes into it. You know, I have freight from North Carolina.
Yeah.
My wreaths, my garland, my tree stands. I mean, we bale the trees. Mm-hmm. The netting costs money. Mm-hmm. So there's some overhead. And, yeah, we work hard out here.
Hard work, social media, and perks like free delivery and recycling pickup have earned Ivy a loyal following. Folks who come back every year, even after leaving the neighborhood. But her model still surprises some customers.
People want me to be a farmer, so they go, well, are you from Wisconsin, or do you live around here? And I'm like, yeah, I do. I don't know if I make people feel bad, like I should be a farmer.
No way. It's a local business.
Yes.
Woman-owned and run business.
Yes, yes, yes.
There are Chicago Christmas tree operators who do happen to be tree farmers. Greg Arneson is one of those. His grandpa started bringing Christmas trees from Wisconsin by schooner nearly 100 years ago, and he carries on the tradition of renting corner lots to sell those northern trees. During most of the year, Arneson lives and works construction in Wisconsin, but for almost a half a century, he spent November and December in Chicago.
Every year, for as long as I can remember, I'm here. Thanksgiving, Christmas, I'm here. So it's like my home, you know. I grew up here as a kid.
But Arneson says this business model of growing and selling the trees, it's starting to fade.
Now the box stores, you know, are carrying trees. You go to the grocery store, you're seeing trees. That never used to be like that.
Arneson says he still manages 6 to 10 Chicago lots a year, and they cater to clients who want something more than the big box experience.
My customers tend to be more picky. They'll come in and they'll spend an hour, sometimes 2 hours, walking around looking for the perfect tree. You know, that's kind of the difference, basically.
This time of year, he spends long days driving between lots, schlepping trees, and doing night deliveries. Each lot is managed by seasonal workers who stay on the property. This year, he's got some Jamaican firemen buddies working, but mostly, he says, they're construction workers like him from Wisconsin. Guys like Chris Peterson, who's keeping warm inside a trailer on one of the lots. I ask him if it's tough work.
Like, we got our cold days, but we got heat in there, fridge in there, stove, microwave, two bunks. Yep, we stay right in the shack. We got a full-size stove in there.
What do you like cooking?
I don't know. Eat a lot of cereal and stuff. Pizza, cook burgers, all kinds of stuff, eggs, bacon.
He says they can make a little scratch for the holidays.
Yeah. Helps out quite a bit at the end of the year. When we're done, it helps out with presents and the family.
So we've seen the lot owner model and the tree farmer model here. But those aren't the only ways to run Christmas tree operations in Chicago. Some are fundraisers for churches and schools. And you're seeing more pop up at restaurants with unused outdoor seating in the winter. Places like 90 Miles and Clybourne and Big Star in Wicker Park. Despite all the work leading up to the big day, tree vendors tell me they're usually able to wrap up several days before Christmas in time to celebrate themselves. Greg Arneson says he donates extra trees to charity or to the zoo for the animals. As a last resort, he chips them up into mulch. But Ivy's experimenting with another solution. The week before Christmas, she leaves all her Charlie Brown leftovers in the lot with just an honor box and a suggested donation. And for the most part, she says people are pretty honorable this time of year. We first aired this story in 2016. And in case you're dying to know, my Christmas sauerkraut turned out great, a beautiful magenta. Jesse Dukes is our audio producer. Shauna Lee edited this story. Extra editorial support came from Jessica Popovac. I'm Monica Eng.
Do you guys need a tree? Do you need a tree?
We got one at the garden shop nearby, but
which one?
Coming next year. Gethsemane.
Oh, you paid a lot of money. Oh, you know how much these trees are over there? Like my
how much?
My 10 to 12 foot.
That segment from the WBEZ Curious City team. Thanks for being with us for this week's Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find all of our episodes at our website, statewideshow.com, and listen to our podcast. It's available through the NPR One app. Join us next time, right here. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.